Right, thank you very much, Mark. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm particularly grateful to you because Mark tells me that nothing at Perimeter starts before 11 o'clock. So I realise that this is a considerable sacrifice. So. Okay. Suddenly, everything becomes clear. Of course, I'm on UK time, so this is about, you know, break afternoon. Anyway. So I'll start by saying just a little bit about brainworm models and about the formation of black holes in these models. But I'm actually going to concentrate on the subsequent evolution of them. Now, traditionally, we model evolution in terms of four stages. And I'm going to say most about the Hawking radiation phases, because that's the bit that I know about. So I should be talking about the semi-classical evolution and some of the results that we know about this. And I'll talk a little bit about how this feeds into actually simulating these events at the LHC. Now, this is going to be a bit of a sort of overview review talk. It's a huge subject area, and I am making no attempt whatsoever to be complete, and I've been very personal and very selective. So I hope that's okay. So, as is well known, in these brain world models, our universe is a brain in some higher dimensional bulk. And this morning, I'm only going to talk about the ADD model, or AADD model, where the extra dimensions are flat and compactified. And the key feature is that standard model particles and forces are constrained to live just on the four-dimensional brain, and only gravitational degrees of freedom can propagate in the bulk. And the consequence of these models is that the fundamental higher dimensional scale of quantum gravity, which I'm going to call M star, may be many orders of magnitude lower than the four-dimensional effective Planck scale, which we observe on the brain. And we have this relationship between the usual four-dimensional Planck scale, N is the number of extra dimensions, and R is the size of the extra dimensions. And of course, on the right-hand side here, we have three unknown quantities with only one constraint between them. So you can play around. We've got quite a lot of freedom in these numbers in order to give us a four-dimensional scale of 10 to the 19 JeV. So because of that freedom, it could be that that fundamental higher dimensional scale could be many orders of magnitude lower, and let's say, for example, that it is as low as a few TeV, the scale of the LHC. So this raises a rather exciting possibility that we could use the LHC to probe quantum gravitational effects. And the particular effect that I'm going to be looking at today is the production of something that looks like a black hole. And the idea behind the process of forming a black hole is a very simple one. It's essentially classical, and the idea is that if you have two particles and you can squeeze the energy of the collision into a small enough region, into a region that's smaller than one of these higher dimensional black holes, then you will form a high dimensional black hole. So a good question is, well, how many of these things are you going to create? And there's an enormous amount of work that's been done on this. So essentially, the parton level cross-section could be approximated by the geometric cross-section. And this gives you, you know, people quote these really very large production cross-sections. So if the fundamental higher dimensional scale of quantum gravity really is 1 TeV, and you've got 6 extra dimensions, then you could produce about 1 black hole per second. And everybody got very excited about this. This is rather over-optimistic, I think. But certainly, and there are a huge number of unknowns, but, you know, there are papers with black hole factories and this sort of thing.
Would it 5 times than the Newton scale black hole be classical?
I'm going to come on to that. In the next slide. So, very good question. So would we expect to actually produce anything that we could even approximately say looks vaguely like a black hole? Because after all, the LHC is not about classical processes. Everything is about quantum field theoretic processes. And even if the fundamental M star is of the, let's say, of about a TeV, it's much more likely that you're going to get some kind of quantum gravity scattering process rather than the formation of something that we would regard as a semi-classical black hole. So Mead and Randall looked at, well, actually, what would we need to, what size would this object need to be for it to approximate a black hole? And in the last couple of weeks, there's been a paper by Casadio and others where they've kind of looked at this issue as well. So Mead and Randall said, well, you certainly need the Compton wavelength of the object that you've formed to be within the Schwarzschild radius for it to even look like a semi-classical black hole. And therefore, you need the energy of the mass of the black hole to be about an order of magnitude greater than M star in order to have something that is approximately semi-classical black hole. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but the one before was 5 times.
Yeah. So I don't think you could even say that that is a black hole, absolutely. So that's one reason why this is far too big. Now, there has been some work done on looking at both these quantum gravity scattering processes and some sort of quantum gravitational state formed in collisions at the LHC that isn't a semi-classical black hole but looks kind of like a gravitational bound state. There are some papers by Karl Mahler, some papers by Gingrich and collaborators. And very recently, ATLAS have actually produced some experimental search is looking for these types of events, but I'm not going to say any more about them. ATLAS haven't seen anything, but they've put some bounds on these processes. Instead, what I want to focus on this morning is how these things evolve. So for the rest of the talk, kind of just imagine that we have formed something at the LHC that looks approximately like a semi-classical black hole. Now, when we form it, it's going to be rapidly rotating, it's going to be really rather asymmetric, and it's going to have some junk attached to it because of the charges of the particles that have collided to make it up. And in terms of modelling, it's nice to split the evolution into four stages. So the first stage is called the balding stage, and here the black hole loses its asymmetries through gravitational radiation and loses the charges and the junk that's stuck to it. At the end of this stage, we have a nice, smooth, axisymmetric, but still rapidly rotating black hole. And the idea is that at this stage, we can start to treat the black hole as a standard semi-classical object and look at its Hawking radiation. And the black hole will lose mass and angular momentum, and at the end of this stage, it will have lost all its angular momentum. This is why this is called spin down. And we're left with a spherically symmetric, Schwarzschild-like, higher dimensional black hole, which will continue to emit Hawking radiation until the very last stages of its life, where the details of quantum gravity processes become important.
It's impossible that black hole retains some related charge. Do you mean it's already in the first stage, in the bulging stage, the charge becomes neutral?
So or
it's not possible that it retains some...
It is possible that it retains some electric charge. So again, that's something that I'm going to talk about a little bit later. It's not been looked at in detail. The traditional picture is that it would lose any electric charge very, very quickly during this phase of the black hole.
Because interaction with... that is not truly a black hole at this stage, if you can lose charge in some sense, no?
Well, you can have a black hole that has some charge.
Maybe not. So your pair production near the horizon, since the electron mass is huge compared to its rest mass, that proceeds very, very quickly, at least presuming you're in the semi-classical regime, essentially in the formation time scale of black holes. So.
the formation times. And
so in some sense, you could say, at least as long as it's the classical, it's charged black holes don't really exist.
It's a new wedge between being a black hole and not when it forms.
Yeah, when they're forming, that's the same time scale for discharge.
It's a Schwinger, to the Schwinger pellet, which is the most important.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. This phase is the one that's been most studied because it's the simplest. I'm going to mostly be talking about this spin down phase, but either way, it's these semi-classical stages that have received the most attention in the literature.
What is spinning down? Of course, a pair of magnets. Why is losing angular momentum?
Sorry, can you?
What is depleting the angular momentum of
the Hawking radiation?
The Hawking radiation, no, it shouldn't.
The Perlmutter mechanism.
The quantum analog of that. So you don't even need a quantum effect. It basically can be classical.
It can, but you do lose angular momentum quantum mechanically as well.
At the classical level, you cannot lose angular momentum unless you interact with
the particles. Is classical, it's not quantum.
Yeah, but it's not good. Super radius, you need particles to be taking energy away. If you have a black hole, the black hole.
That is the Perlmutter mechanism, which is the particle. Super radiance is enough that it's a stimulated emission, okay, but that environment is not clean
by
waves hinting at the black hole. And
there are classical waves.
You can super radiate, but
you don't need the quantum particles.
But yeah, but you're already in the semi classical regime. I think at the classical level, you wouldn't have it unless you. And we have a sea of particles that are taking the energy away, the angular momentum away.
So this is ignoring the interaction of the black holes with any residual fields that are left outside. Even if you just consider the Hawking radiation, it will shed its angular momentum as well as mass. Okay, I'm into... So this is kind of coming back to the question about shedding the charge. But first of all, talking about in the balding phase, shedding mass and angular momentum, and usually we model these as part of the formation process of the black hole. So the sort of thing we're interested in is, well, how much energy of the collision is going to be radiated during this formation process in gravitational radiation. So these are very much upper bounds. Recent numerical relativity work in higher dimensions indicates that a bound of, I think, about half this. So there's going to be a certain amount of energy lost in gravitational radiation as the black hole forms. And we also are interested in, well, how quickly is the black hole spinning at the start of this spin-down phase? Now, in principle, if you have a higher dimensional black hole with more than one extra dimension, then you can write down a metric with a potentially unbounded angular momentum. In practice, you're limited by the maximum impact parameter. So if your particles are too far away, you won't actually fall from each other when they collide. You won't actually form a black hole in the first place.
You're just limiting yourself to topological black holes, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, just for simplicity. again, numerical work, this is old work, but more recent numerical work suggests that you can in fact produce black holes that are really rotating quite quickly by these particle collisions. So although this is in five dimensions, if this parameter J was 1, that would indicate a maximally rotating black hole. So J is 0.93 is quite big.
Is there numerically evident that you cannot create anything with J greater than 1? I mean, is the cosmic censorship somehow corroborated by this kind of calculation?
So if N is... If we're in either 4 or 5D, then in order to have a horizon around your singularity, then your angular momentum is bounded, okay? And it must be less than J equals 1. So that happens for Kerr. If you're in 6 or higher dimensions, at least from the point of view of cosmic censorship, the angular momentum can be unbounded and you still have the singularity behind the event horizon.
Right. But I was wondering if... you can find a somehow solution where apparently there is a naked singularity.
No, so far the numerical evidence in 4D, so people can try it, and they can.
Yeah. Try harder and failed.
Yeah.
So my question is the same, because
it was easy to predict the
somehow. The physics is forbidding.
Yeah,
so this is interesting. It's really some cosmic censorship. Made real.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's an example in which apparently there is.
Yeah, because he said it would be very nice at the LHC if these particles were colliding, making that naked singularities.
There are a lot of people that are afraid of this possibility.
Yeah. Okay. In going back to shedding charges, QCD effects are going to be huge at the LHC. There really is very little work done on the interaction of these black holes with QCD. Electromagnetic effects, coming back, I'm going to say a little bit more about Sampaio's work a bit later in the talk. But what he has argued is that the loss of electric charge by the black hole may not be as rapid as you might think due to swinger discharge. And the reason is that the traditional picture, you think, well, the electromagnetic force is so much stronger than gravity, effectively, which is why Schwinger discharge is going to be so rapid. But, of course, the whole point about TeV-scale gravity models is that in the higher dimensions, the higher dimensional gravity is of a similar, is very much stronger than four-dimensional gravity. So Sampaio has argued that, in fact, this Schwinger discharge process may not be as rapid as you might naively think in these TV scale models. So the charge may be significant. Okay, so I'm going to now look at the Hawking radiation phases. And I need to start by actually looking at how we model these small black holes at the end of this balding phase. Now, the simplest model that I'm going to consider is taking the metric of a higher dimensional black hole, which is the famous Myers-Perry metric, and I'm simply going to take a slice through this to give me a four-dimensional metric on the brain of what this higher dimensional black hole looks like. So here's the standard Myers-Perry metric. This is the higher dimensional bit, and I'm considering a black hole that's rotating just in the brain. Mu here is a parameter for the mass of the black hole. A parameterizes the angular momentum. And I hope it's clear that the metric depends explicitly on the number of extra dimensions, n. So if I take a slice through this, this is the effective four-dimensional metric that I will get. And because I've taken a slice through a higher dimensional metric, I still have a dependence on the number of extra dimensions. And if I set n equal to 0, I get back the usual Kerr black hole. So what are we interested in? We're interested in looking at the Hawking radiation. First of all, on the brain, because these are particles that potentially we can detect at the LHC. And we'll get all the usual standard model particles. There's also going to be gravitational radiation on the brain. And in order to study these objects, we just consider that slice, that four-dimensional metric that we had on the previous slide. Now, while we can't observe radiation into the bulk, there is nonetheless going to be gravitational degrees of freedom that are radiated into the bulk. And it's important to know about these because they're going to contribute to the missing energy in an event, and that's something that experimentalists can consider. And in order to study this, we need to look at the full higher dimensional black hole metric. So the Hawking temperature, this is a plot just for the non-rotating case. And in this case, the lifetime of the black hole is about 10 to the minus 26 seconds. So these black holes are going to evaporate, at least in the standard picture, in a very rapid, very short lifetime. So in order to study the Hawking radiation, we use the standard techniques of quantum field theory and curved space-time. I'm going to regard the black hole geometry as fixed and classical and study the quantum fields on this background. Now, the formalism for this was developed by Tucholsky in the 70s. And he writes down a master equation which governs quantum fields of spin 0, half 1 and 2, propagating on a Kerr black hole background. Now, for spin 0, 1 half and 1, that formalism can be extended very easily, first of all to that 4D slice, and in the spin 0 case, also to particles propagating in the bulk as well as on the brain. I'll come back to spin 2 a bit later. So essentially what you do is in each case you have a quantity psi which governs your field, and the exact form of this depends on the spin of the field you're considering. And we perform a standard Fourier mode decomposition. So here omega is the frequency of the mode, n is the azimuthal quantum number. I've got a spin-weighted spheroidal harmonic, and there's also a radial function, half.
Let me ask a question. You're talking about the Tarkovsky equation, right? So the four dimension, he's writing things in terms of psi 4, which we understand what it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not clear what psi 4 is in higher dimension.
Yeah.
So you've taken now a slice.
Yeah.
But now, how do you know these perturbations would even leap on the slice? Or right on the black hole?
Yeah, so in the gravitational case, so in the spin 2 case, there is, to the best of my knowledge, and you'll know better than I do, that there is no equivalent of the Tucholsky equation in for higher dimensional perturbations of Mies-Perry. So the formalism hasn't been developed, and to the, as far as I know, the equations don't separate.
Right.
So this is one reason why, in fact, the gravitational radiation in the rotating case has not been done in full, because we can't work with the equations.
Right, but so you're
going to
use it to...
I'm only going to do that.
Okay.
But in principle, it could also have scalar perturbation that lead in...
Yes, so you can do scalars in the bulk, but gravitational radiation in the bulk you can't. We don't have the machinery to do that.
Okay.
Is it a full bulk extension or just for perturbations, just the slice, perturbation on the slice?
So we can do perturbations on the slice for 0, 1, half and 1, mm-hmm. and we can do perturbations in the bulk for spin 0. There's no point in doing perturbations in the bulk for 1, half and 1, but you could do if you really wanted to. Okay. So these are the sorts of things that we're interested in calculating, which are emission rates for particles, energy and angular momentum per unit time. Per unit frequency. And here I've written them where they're integrated over all angles outside in the four dimensions. So exactly what the fluxes look like depends on which one we're calculating. They're always written in terms of a sum over these Fourier modes. Omega tilde here depends on the angular rotation of the black hole event horizon. We've got the usual boson or fermion factor. And at the top here, we have the famous grey body factor. So all the hard work is in actually calculating these things. And the grey body factor encodes the fact that the emission is not precisely thermal. And it describes the interaction of the emitted quanta with the gravitational potential that's surrounding the black hole. And you can compute it for example, if you consider a wave that's going outward from the event horizon of a black hole, it's the proportion of the flux of that outgoing radiation that tunnels through the gravitational potential, so the flux that you get at infinity, divided by the outgoing flux at the horizon. So here are some example plots. So on the left-hand side, I've got some plots of these grey body factors for gauge boson emission and for a 10-dimensional black hole. And this is just for one particular field mode. And as I go from red up to light blue, I'm increasing the rotation of the black hole. So what you can see is that the grey body factor is always zero. This is as a function of the frequency, omega. So it's always zero at zero frequency. If I've got no energy in my outgoing wave, it can't tunnel through. And then for high energy waves, the whole of the wave, the grey body factor goes to one, the whole of the wave tunnels through the gravitational potential. The key feature to note as well is that we get this region here where the grey body factor is negative. And this is going back to classical superradiance. So this is where we get an enhancement in a classical wave because it's extracting the angular momentum of the black hole. On the right-hand side, I've plotted as an example fermion emission spectra. So these are particle fluxes, again as a function of frequency omega. In this case, I fixed the spin of the black hole, and as I go from red up to black, I'm increasing the number of extra dimensions from 1 all the way up to 7. So the key features, for comparatively low numbers of extra dimensions, you can see we get these wiggles in the particle flux. And this is due to specific modes becoming important at different frequencies. And this effect gets smeared out as we increase the number of extra dimensions. You can also see that the magnitude of the flux increases significantly with the number of extra dimensions, as does the tail. And this is primarily a temperature effect. So in the units that I'm using, the temperature increases as we increase the number of extra dimensions. The black holes get hotter.
And what are you using for the radius of the black hole?
So I'm using the radius of the black hole as my unit of length.
Right, yeah. What radius? So your n equals 1 would be 5 dimensions?
So n equals 1 is 5 dimensions. I'm going up to 11 dimensions when n equals 7. Now, one thing that's particularly interesting in the spin-down phase is to look at the angular distribution of the fluxes. So this is the energy emission rate as a function of angle. This is the flux that we had before, and we also have some dependence on these spin-weighted spheroidal harmonics. So in these plots and the ones on the next slide, I've got energy flux up on the z-axis. I'm sorry, it's quite hard to read. On this axis here, this is going to be frequency. And on this axis here, I've got the angle. So this line here always corresponds to the axis of rotation of the black hole. And the line through the middle corresponds to the equatorial plane of the black hole. So these plots are for positive helicity fermions and gauge bosons. And you can see that the emission is very much preferential in one hemisphere. And what happens is you'll get the negative helicity being preferentially emitted in the other hemisphere. So we get non-symmetric emission due to the spin of the black hole. The other key feature that you can see is that at comparatively low frequencies, we get this large peak of emission along the axis of rotation. And this is due to the coupling between the spin of the particle that I'm emitting and the fact that the black hole is rotating. So it's a spin-orbit coupling effect at comparatively low frequencies. The other thing which, I don't know if you can see the numbers at the back, is that you're getting about an order of magnitude more emission in gauge bosons than you are in fermions. So again, just to compare the angular distribution for different spins, this is for a six-dimensional black hole, again the same axes, and I've got plots for scalars, fermions and gauge bosons. So in this case, again, you can see very much for gauge bosons this preferential emission along the axis of rotation. So in these plots, I've added both positive and negative helicity spins, which is why these are symmetric. But you can also see quite clearly, particularly for scalars and fermions, that you're getting preferential emission in the equatorial plane of the black hole, particularly for the higher frequencies. And again, this is what you'd expect from the fact that the black hole is rotating. You'd expect more particles to get fired out along the equatorial plane of emission. Okay, so these are results just for massless particles on this Myers-Perry slice metric. So what's
There is a strong dependence on this n, on the dimension.
There is strong dependence on the number of dimensions as well, because you've got these kind of two effects, this effect of going along the axis and then going along the equatorial plane, and that depends on the number of extra dimensions as to exactly where each of those kicks in as well. Yeah. So, I mean, if you wanted to be really optimistic, you could say, well, can you use, if you saw one of these things, the sort of angular distributions that you were getting to read off, you know, to find out how many extra dimensions there are. Of course, in practice, that's rather more difficult. But there is very strong dependence on the number of extra dimensions, yeah. And I've actually got some simulation plots at the end, and again, you'll see the dependence on the number of dimensions. Okay, so by far the most work has been done on the spherically symmetric Schwarzschild phase, and essentially all the emission, both on the brain and in the bulk, has been studied in detail in that case. In the spin-down phase, as I've already said, all the emission on the brain of the standard model particles has been looked at, and in the bulk, we've looked only at the scalar case. There are some partial results for gravitational emission in the bulk, and I'll be a little bit more precise about that shortly. Now, one important question is, well, how much of the radiation is going to disappear in the bulk and that we're just not going to be able to see at all? So Emperor and Horowitz and Myers have argued that because of the huge number of degrees of freedom that we have in the standard model, most of the emission must be on the brain. The complication with that is that as you increase the number of extra dimensions, the number of gravitational degrees of freedom goes up really quite quickly. But they've argued that the number of degrees of freedom in the standard model is so huge that that's always going to win. But just as an example, this is some results just for one degree of freedom, so just for one massless scalar. And what we've seen is that the rotation of the black hole helps. So as you increase the rotation of the black hole, the proportion of the radiation that's being emitted in the bulk goes down quite dramatically as well. So that's looking good for getting most of the radiation actually on the brain. Now, that's looking at the simplest possible case. In the last few years, most of the work has concentrated on looking at more complicated effects. And I'm just going to give you a flavour of some of the things that people have looked at. So first of all, a natural thing to consider would be, well, what about massive particles? After all the particles that we're going to, all the fermions we're going to detect at the LHC have all got mass. So what happens is kind of what you would expect. You can't, if you've got a massive particle, you can't emit a particle of mass with energy less than its rest mass. So what happens is you get fewer particles emitted, but each particle has got greater energy because of the mass of the particles. In my simple Myers-Perry slice model, I've just taken this high-dimensional black hole and I've taken a slice through it. So I've not really said anything very much about the brain. And in particular, it's possible that the brain will have some tension attached to it. Now, if you have a six-dimensional black hole, there's actually an exact metric in this case where the brain has tension. So if you're doing these types of calculations, life is very, very much easier if you have a metric in closed form to work with. So all the work is done in examples where you've got a closed form metric. So what this brain tension does is it reduces the bulk emission. So it makes emission on the brain much more likely. This plot is slightly confusing because the B equals 1, the parameter B indicates zero tension if B is 1. So in fact, as these curves go down, so this is scalar field emission in the bulk, and as the curves go down, the tension in the brain is increasing. So you can see the suppression. There's also been some work done looking at more complicated metrics. So, for example, if you consider not a Myers-Perry black hole, but a black hole solution of gravity with a Gauss-Bonnet correction term, then there is an exact metric that is known for a spherically symmetric black hole. So in higher dimensional gravity, the Gauss-Bonnet term is the first correction that you might reasonably have to the gravitational Lagrangian. So these black holes have a rather lower temperature than the corresponding usual Schwarzschild-like black hole, and therefore both brain and bulk emission is correspondingly reduced, and these black holes are longer lived than the spherically symmetric Schwarzschild-like ones. I first have to say a little bit more about emission of charge. So Sampaio looked at the metric for a charged black hole where there is an electromagnetic field just on the brain and not in the bulk. So he's not looking at a higher dimensional Reisner-Nordström black hole. He's just got the electromagnetic field on the brain. And he looked at the emission of charged particles from this charged black hole. So the grey body factors are at the top. This is just for the spherically symmetric case to keep things simple. And you can see that, again, there's a region where the grey body factor is negative. So you get a kind of charge superradiance effect for the emission of charged particles from a charged black hole. This is known in the ordinary case. This is nothing to do with brain black holes. This is the particle emission spectrum. So the top curve is for emission of particles that have the same sign charge as the black hole. And as we go down, the charge of the particles reduces. The red curve at the bottom is for the emission of particles having oppositely signed charge to the black hole. So I guess the key feature of this curve at the bottom, and the last few at the bottom, is that this is non-zero. So there are non-zero probabilities of the black hole actually charging itself up by emitting a particle that's got an opposite sign charge to what it has. I thought I'd mention very briefly some work in progress. So we've said that we're taking this semi-classical approximation and we're regarding the black hole as having a fixed classical metric. But we've argued that quantum gravity effects are going to be important, certainly at the end of the lifetime of the black hole and also in general in physics at the LHC. But we don't really know very much about full quantum gravity black holes. And it's much easier to do calculations if you have an exact metric. So various authors have constructed classical black holes, but using a smeared mass distribution inspired by ideas in non-commutative geometry to kind of mimic some effective effects that we might get if we had a better, we had a full quantum gravity black hole. So essentially what happens is that instead of the usual Schwarzschild metric, you get a metric involving these incomplete gamma functions, but it's still closed form, so you can work with it. And this is an example of what the metric looks like. So in these plots and on the next page, blue is ordinary Schwarzschild, and black is for these non-commutative geometry-inspired black holes. So one thing that's nice about these is the metric looks like Schwarzschild far from the black hole. But whereas Schwarzschild has a singularity, here the metric remains regular at the origin. And these black holes have rather lower temperatures than the Schwarzschild black holes of the corresponding size. So they're going to live, they're going to have longer lifetimes. So what we're doing is we're actually looking at how this affects the Hawking radiation. And there are two effects happening here. First of all, these have got lower temperature, these black holes. And secondly, it's been argued that this sort of smearing is going to affect the spectrum. And you will get an additional damping term in your spectrum of emitted radiation. And the question is, well, which two of these are most important? So these are some preliminary results just looking at scalar field emission on the brain. And what you can see in this case is that the solid lines are for the standard Hawking radiation spectrum for Schwarzschild and for these modified black holes. And the dotted lines are this power spectrum that has the different, the slightly more damping in it. And what you can see is that by far the dominant effect is the fact that the NC black holes have got rather smaller temperature than the Schwarzschild-like black holes. And the extra damping term, in fact, makes very little difference at all. What I suspect, although I haven't done this yet, is that as we deal with higher dimensional black holes, because the metric, because the temperature is going to be higher, that this additional damping will become more important, but that's very much work in progress. Okay, so where are we up to? I've already said that we don't have complete results for the graviton radiation for the higher dimensional rotating black hole. The only results that there are for tensor-type gravitational perturbations, which exist when you have at least three extra dimensions. And the reason is that in this case, we know what the equation is for those perturbations. It's separable, and you can work with it. Now, in everything that I've said so far, I've been working with this classical black hole and essentially the continuum approximation. I've been looking at continuous emission from this fixed metric. Now, of course, in reality, what happens if you've got a black hole at the LHC is that the black hole is going to emit particles. We've got a stochastic process. And essentially what I've been calculating are the probabilities for the particle, for a particular particle with a particular energy to be emitted in a particular direction. The black hole is going to recoil from the emission of particles. It's going to react to the emission of particles. It's possible that if the black hole emits a graviton into the bulk, that it may recoil and even come off the brain and disappear off into the bulk. And it's certainly the case that it's not going to have time to settle down into an equilibrium configuration between emissions.
Is it so true that once you have any realistic brain model, you better have a strongly confining potential, otherwise, say, the binary pulsars would be completely off?
Sorry, could you...
Okay, so with any realistic brain model, you've got to effectively confine things close to the brain, otherwise, for example, the binary pulsars would...
There are strong constraints from astrophysical processes, yes.
So is your worry about, once you take that into account, is that... Do you still think you can get black holes that are going to recoil off the brain once you take that into account? Or do you know?
It's still a possibility just because the scales are so different. So, for example, I'm going to say a little bit just in a moment about one of the black hole simulators, which does actually try and model this process and look at how likely it is that the black hole will disappear off into the bulk. Now, their simulations do reveal that the black hole basically just stays. It's very unlikely that it would disappear off, but at least a priori. Because if it emits a graviton, it's going to lose a significant amount of its energy. I mean, the great thing about binary pulsar is if a binary pulsar, you know, one graviton isn't going to knock it off into the bulk.
Sure, but it's just saying, you know, there's got to be a pretty strong effective potential confining area. And
absolutely.
If a graviton isn't comparable to that energy, then you can just stay put.
And obviously, if you've got a tense brain, again, that helps because it tends to pull things towards it. Okay. So if experimentalists being optimistic are either going to discover or rule out black holes at the LHC, we need to know what they look like. And a number of event simulators have been produced. So the state of the art really are the ones called Black Max and Charybdis, and they're being used by the ATLAS experimental groups. Those of you who are going to the conference in Niagara next week, I think Dejan Stojkovic is going to be talking about Black Max, so I'm not going to say anything more about that. I'm going to talk about some results from Charybdis 2, because that's the one that I know more about. It's developed by the Cambridge group in the UK, and also they use our results, so it must be better. These two are kind of complementary, so as you might expect, Black Max includes some effects that aren't in Charybdis 2, and Charybdis 2 includes some effects that aren't in Black Max, so they're complementary. QBH is a bit different, so this is actually trying to model really quantum black holes, so trying to, in particular, sort of incorporating QCD effect. So he's trying to simulate something very different from the other two. So these are just a couple of results from Charybdis simulations, just to give you a flavour. So some of the things that experimentalists are interested in are, for example, the number of particles that are going to be emitted in one of these processes, and what is going to be the energy spectrum of those emitted particles. Now, in both these plots, the solid lines indicate non-rotating black holes, and the dotted lines are for rotating black holes. And green's a bit faint, is for two extra dimensions, red for four, and black for six extra dimensions, just to give you an idea. So what I hope you can see from these graphs is that when you include rotation, you get rather fewer particles emitted, but those particles have higher energy, so you get a much flatter energy spectrum when you include rotation, but you're getting fewer particles emitted. Something that we've been very interested in is how does actually the black hole evolve over its lifetime. So if you can cast your minds back to near the beginning, we said we had these four stages in the lifetime of the black hole. And the spherically symmetric stage, the Schwarzschild light phase, is by far the easiest. And initially, people thought that would be by far the dominant phase, so that for most of its life, the black hole would be essentially spherically symmetric. So these plots show the evolution of the mass and spin of the black hole over its lifetime. So the top plots show mass and spin as a function of the proportion of the lifetime of the black hole. So this is the end of when the black hole disappears. And in each case, the solid lines are the means, and the error bars indicate standard deviations in the evolution. The bottom plots kind of show the same thing in a different way. Here, the mass and spin are shown as functions of the Hawking emission number. So what does the mass distribution look like after one particle has been emitted two, and so on. And red, in this case, is the dominant, the most likely configurations. So what you can see on the left-hand plot, so you can see that the mass of the black hole goes down really quite steadily over its lifetime and goes down particularly quickly towards the end of its life. So you can see here there's this dominant phase where the black hole is steadily losing mass and then disappears. Spin is a bit different. So the black hole loses its angular momentum initially very, very quickly. And you can see this, that the red is very much for very low spins down here. So it's losing its spin very quickly. But that the spin then doesn't stay at a low level, but doesn't disappear away to zero. And in fact, there's a slight increase in the spin of the black hole at the end of its life. So the message from this is that this spin-down phase, that the rotation of the black hole, while small, is non-zero and is significant for much of the life of the black hole. And there are, in fact, very few black hole events where the black hole really does lose all its angular momentum quickly at the start of its life. So, has anybody seen these things? CMS produced a paper just before Christmas looking for these semi-classical black holes. And they used the primarily Blackmax as a simulator, but they did also compare with the Charybdis output. And they were able to rule out black holes with masses between 3.5 and 4.5 TeV for fundamental quantum gravitational scale up to about 3 TeV. Now, in the last couple of weeks, Parker's pointed out that with these assumptions, you're not going to see anything that looks like a semi-classical black hole. We need to have a black hole of mass at least an order of magnitude more than the fundamental quantum gravitational scale before we can start to talk about it being approximately a semi-classical black hole. So in a sense, CMS haven't seen these black holes because you wouldn't expect to see them at those sorts of energy scales. Perfect. Okay, so we've looked at the evolution of classical, semi-classical black holes at the LHC. And this is modelled in terms of four stages. Of course, in reality, you know, the black hole doesn't sit there and think, right, balding phase now, let's do that, and then we move on to the next one. The lines get blurred between them, but it's useful for modelling purposes. The balding phase is very complicated because we've got the coupling between the black hole and matter, because we've got a lack of symmetry. The semi-classical Hawking radiation phases have been studied in great detail, and we really know a lot about that, apart from the gravitational radiation from a rotating black hole. We don't understand what happens at the endpoint of the black hole evolution. The simulators include various different options. And I think it's fair to say that we really do need to understand the more likely situation for the LHC, which is the production of things that genuinely quantum gravitational types of mini black holes rather than these semi-classical objects. Excellent. Thank you.
I have a question on the previous slide. So I haven't seen the comment by Tariq. So I, of course, completely agree that the semi-classical model is not valid at these energy ranges. But how far is that relevant for the analysis they do to begin with? I mean, if I recall correctly, they were just looking at multi-jet events. And see zero excess over the background.
Yes.
So for that comment to actually matter, he would need to claim that so that the black hole does not make any multi-jet event. Is that the point?
I don't think he's saying there's anything wrong with the CMS analysis, but I'm not an experimentalist. So
Let's just assume the analysis is.
So I think we can assume that their analysis is analysis, and I don't think he's saying that you wouldn't expect if you really did have a semi-classical black hole. He's saying that their assumptions of the sort of events to look at are the sort of events that you should be looking at. He's just saying that effectively that their result isn't as significant, perhaps, because we wouldn't be expecting to see semi-classical black holes, and they're not seeing any semi-classical black holes.
So if, you know, a really quantum gravitational black hole would not make any multi-jet events, is that
My understanding is that a full quantum gravitational black hole, the dominant effect is likely to be a dijet, which is what ATLAS were looking for. Mm-hmm. So ATLAS looked for excesses of dijet events. As signatures of new physics, I don't think they were necessarily looking at them just in terms of quantum gravitational black holes. And again, they didn't see an excess. So the ATLAS paper is quite hard to find because it doesn't have black hole in the title. It says excess of dijet events at blah, blah, blah. I have got the number if you are.
Yeah, I saw it.
If you're in March,
I would probably find it.
Yeah, absolutely. So. But I don't think that's not relevant for the CMS paper, because the CMS paper, they're not pretending to look for those sorts of things. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So again, perhaps a lot more than the question, but so this calculation again, in order to do it, you take a slice, you do something here. So I got some issues about. Okay, so at the end of the day, you want to put something. A prediction that then you can help the people of the experiment to code or something, right? But it depends on the fact that you assume a particular slice. I mean, if you take another slice, maybe the results would change slightly. Also, you're assuming you were taking some given black hole solution.
Yep.
And we know that in higher dimensions, this zoo of possible solutions is not well understood. I mean, there could be other black holes.
Absolutely.
Even those that are understood, they're not unique.
Yep.
So why pick these particular black holes with the perturbations of over,
because it's the simplest.
Right, but that may not be what nature gives us.
Precisely, absolutely. So, I mean, one difficulty with quite a lot of these high dimensional examples is that metrics are really complicated.
Yeah.
And they're quite nasty to work with. You know, I certainly would, and some of them, you sort of think, well, actually, you know, just dealing with even scale of perturbations on that background is going to be really very unwieldy. Absolutely.
Yeah, so there is some kind of disconnect between what the theorists can do and what the experimentalists would get.
On the optimistic side, you can say probably, from what we don't know much, but what we do know, probably the smart money is on the fact that most of the exotic ones are unstable.
But what's important then is the time scale of the instability.
I mean, maybe those will come much.
I would expect actually, if anything, the dominant signature, if these things form, would be, you know, it's going to be the final poof process, right?
Yeah, but the poof would be, those black holes are unstable, the poof could be considered a different poof here, right?
I don't know. I mean, presumably you get down to the quantum scale and, you know, well, if you at least believe the conventional picture, then, you know, it all converts into itself into radiation of all sorts of particles and that. I presume that would be noticeable, but...
We wouldn't be able to model. We don't know how to model the proof bit. Well, you probably can.
We know that we need
right,
more
so
for this.
So one can. Yeah. From there to help the experiment, I mean, it could be a huge gap.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're quite right, and we don't understand how dependent some of these features are on things like the particular nature of the black hole, because really what the experimentalists would be some fairly generic features that they can look for, you know, but because we don't have a detailed understanding of the different types mm-hmm. of model, that it's quite difficult.
But from the point of view, I think the experimentalists are looking for something, a particular effect that this cannot be explained within the range of standard model. So from this point of view, I think this is rather not so relevant if this or the other model is...
looking for an anomaly.
It's an anomaly.
Yeah. Then once you have the anomaly, you can see if you can fit it with a simplest model, or you have really to develop some new machinery.
Yeah.
I agree, but then the anomaly doesn't require input from theorists.
Sure. But I think that is a fact. I mean, they will see if there is an anomaly in the data.
It needs some input from the theorists, because if I understand, because you need to, because they don't record all events at the LHC, so you need some kind of trigger.
Yeah, but in a certain sense, if there is new particle physics, you have a better control of what kind of anomaly you expect.
Yeah.
So if I think if what they're looking for is really, which is not standard particle physics, and is not standard, especially anomaly coming from... you know, extension of the standard model and so on.
I think that they need something, because particularly Atlas, it's rather weird everything that comes out. So
general feature probably.
The worry is that you have to look over there when you should be looking over there.
Yeah, but what can you do? You
no,
look
I know,
the
I know.
Keys. you know, what the light is. I can get the black guy that is looking for the keys after rather than in the dark, you know?
I think that the stage, the tales of the theory are all of it. A rough feature that can be
I don't think that exit is so serious.
No, I think that the only people that took this thing seriously are common people that were afraid of a giant black hole.
Okay, so Elizabeth will be around in Coimbra until next Tuesday, and then she's going over to the Niagara Falls Conference. If you wish to listen to Elizabeth give a talk on...
It's a different talk in Niagara, I promise.
Okay, so let's thank
Elizabeth.